breaking away to push my hair back over my shoulders. Larry, the cameraman, is a very heavy sleeper, Leon says, finding my mouth again and kissing me slowly. My heart is already thundering. I feel a little dizzy, as if all the blood that usually hangs around in my head has decided it has other places to be. Our lips barely parting, Leon lifts me up so I'm sitting on the Aga warming plate, and I wrap my legs around him, linking my ankles behind his body. He presses against me. I become gradually aware of the heat from the Aga working its way through my flannel pyjama bottoms and beginning to scald my bum. "Ah, Bernie," I say, pushing forward so Leon takes my weight. He lifts me up koala bear style and moves me to the sideboard instead, his lips slowly beginning to trace patterns all over me, neck and chest, lips again, neck, collarbone, lips. My head is starting to spin, I'm barely thinking. His hands find the narrow opening between my jumpers and pyjama bottoms, and then his hands are on my skin, and barely thinking becomes not thinking at all. "Is it bad to have sex on a surface where other people prepare food?" Leon asks, pulling away, breathless. "No, it's just clean, hygienic," I say, pulling him back to me. "Good," he says, and suddenly all my jumpers are off in one go. I'm not cold at all any longer. In fact, I could do with wearing fewer clothes. Why the hell didn't I wear the negligee? I yank off Leon's t-shirt and tug at the waistband of his jogging bottoms until he slips those off too. As I slide my body up against his, he pauses for a moment. "Okay?" he asks hoarsely. I can see the control he's taking to ask the question. I answer with another kiss. "Yes," he says, mouth against mine. "This means okay?" "Yes, now stop talking," I tell him, and he does as he's told. We're so close. I'm almost naked, he's almost naked, my head is full of Leon. This is it. It's happening. My inner sexually frustrated Victorian almost weeps with gratitude as Leon pulls me towards him by the hips, so I'm pressed up against him, his body back between my legs. And then, there it is. The remembering. I stiffen. He doesn't clock it at first, and for 3 deeply horrible seconds his hands are still moving over my body, his lips still pressed hard against mine. It's very hard to describe this feeling. Panic, perhaps, but I'm completely immobile and feel strangely passive. I'm frozen, trapped, and have this odd sensation that some crucial part of me has detached itself. Leon's hands slow, coming to a halt on either side of my face. He lifts my head gently to look at him. "Ah," he says. He disentangles himself from me just as I begin to shake all over. I can't seem to get that part of me back. I don't know where this feeling came from. One moment I was about to have the sex I'd been fantasizing over all week, and the next I was remembering something. A body that wasn't Leon's, hands that were doing the same thing, but I didn't want them there. "You want space or a hug?" he asks simply, standing a foot away from me now. "Hug," I manage. He gathers me to him, reaching for the heap of jumpers on the counter as he does so. He drapes one over my shoulder and cuddles me close, my head pressed against his chest. The only giveaway of how frustrated he must be feeling is the thud, thud of his heartbeat in my ear. "I'm sorry," I mutter into his chest. "You should never be that," he says. "Not sorry, okay?" I smile shakily, pressing my lips to his skin. "Okay."
Chapter 54. I'm not usually an angry person. I'm generally mild-mannered and hard to rile. It's always me who stops Richie fighting. Usually I'm half a woman who may or may not need any assistance. But now something primal seems to be happening, and it's taking enormous effort to keep my body relaxed and movements gentle. Hostile posture and tenseness will not help Tiffy, but I want to hurt him. Really. Don't know what he did to Tiffy, what in particular triggered her this time. But whatever it was, it has hurt her so much she's trembling all over like a kitten come in from the cold. She surfaces, wiping her face.
Sorry, hi.
Hi? You want a tea? She nods. Don't want to let go of her, but holding on after she's expecting me to is probably a bad plan. Dress again and head to Kettle.
That was...
Wait. Kettle begins to boil. Just a quiet rumble.
That was really horrible. I don't even know what happened.
Was it a new memory or something you've already talked through with the counsellor? She shakes her head, frowning. It wasn't like a memory. It's not like something came into my mind's eye. More like muscle memory? She looks up. Yeah, exactly. Pour the teas. Open fridge for milk and pause. It's filled with trays of little pink cupcakes iced with F and J. Tiffy pads over to join me, sliding an arm around my waist. Ooh, these must be for the wedding happening after we leave. How close do you think they paid attention to the quantity? Tiffy laughs. Not quite a full laugh, and a little wet with tears, but still, good. Probably very. Although there are so many. Too many. I'd estimate 300. Nobody invites 300 people to their wedding. Unless they're really famous or Indian. Is it a famous Indian person's wedding? Lordy Lordy Illustrator didn't explicitly say so. Pinch two cupcakes and give one to Tiffy. Her eyes are still a little pink from crying, but she's smiling now and eats the cupcake in almost one bite. Suspect she needs sugar. We eat in silence for a while, moving to lean against Aga side by side. So, in your professional opinion, as a palliative care nurse, as a vaguely medical person. Oh no, these conversations never go well. People always assume they teach us all the medicine in the world at nursing school and that we remember it 5 years later. Am I going to freak out like this every time we're about to have sex? Because that is literally the most depressing thought ever. Me, very carefully. I suspect not. May just take time to work out triggers and how to avoid them until you feel safer. She looks at me sharply. I'm not. I don't want you to think. He never, you know, hurt me. Would like to dispute that. Seems he has hurt her rather a lot. But it's definitely not my place. So I just fetch her another cupcake and hold it up for her to bite. I'm not presuming anything. Just want you to feel better. Tiffy stares at me. Then, from nowhere, pokes me in the cheek. Me, with a yelp. Hey! Cheek poke is a lot more startling than I'd realised when I did it to her earlier. You're not real, are you? You're implausibly nice. I'm not. I'm a grumpy old man who dislikes most people. Most? There are a small number of exceptions. How do you choose them? The exceptions? Shrug. Uncomfortable. Really? Seriously? Why me? Well, I suppose there are some people I just feel comfortable with. Not many, but you were one before I even met you. Tiffy looks at me, head tilted, eyes holding my gaze for so long I twist on the spot, itching to drop the subject. Eventually she leans forward and kisses me slowly, tasting of icing. I'll be worth the wait. You'll see. As if I ever doubted it.
Chapter 55. I lean back in my desk chair, taking my eyes off the screen. I've been staring at it for way too long. The Castle knitwear photos have been picked up on Daily Mail's Female, and it's weird. Catherine is officially a celebrity. I can't believe how quickly this has happened, and also can't stop reading comments from other women about how hot Leon is in those photos. I obviously already know he's hot, but still, it's simultaneously horrible and kind of good to get external validation. I wonder how he's feeling about it. I'm hoping he's too technologically incapable to scroll to the comments section on the Daily Mail, because some of the comments are really quite X-rated. There's obviously a few racist ones in there as well, this being a comment section on the internet, and everything briefly descends into an argument about global warming being a liberalist conspiracy. And before I know it, I've circled my way into the plug hole of the internet and wasted half an hour following people's outlandish opinions on whether Trump is a neo-Nazi and whether Leon's ears are too big. I go to counselling after work. As per usual, Lucy sits in borderline uncomfortable silence for a while, and then, seemingly spontaneously, I start telling her awful, painful stuff I mostly can't even bear to think about. How cleverly Justin made me believe I had a bad memory so he could always say I'd misremembered things. how brazenly he convinced me I'd thrown a bunch of clothes out when really he'd just been chucking stuff he didn't like me wearing to the back of the wardrobe. How subtly he turned sex into something I owed him, even when he'd made me so sad I couldn't think straight. It's all business as usual for Lucy, though. She just nods, or tilts her head, or sometimes, in extreme cases, when I've said something out loud that almost physically hurts to utter, she says a supportive yes. This time she asks me at the end of the session how I think I'm getting on. I start with the usual stuff. Oh, this has been so great, honestly, thanks so much. Like when the hairdresser asks if you like the cut they've just given you. But Lucy just stares at me for a while, so then I think, how actually am I getting on? A couple of months ago I couldn't face saying no to Justin taking me out for a drink. I was expending most of my mental energy keeping memories at bay. I wasn't even willing to acknowledge that he'd abused me. And now, here I am, talking to someone who isn't Mo about how what happened with Justin wasn't my fault, and actually believing it. I listen to a lot of Kelly Clarkson on my way home on the tube. Facing my reflection in the glass, I throw my shoulders back and meet my own gaze, just like that first train journey from Justin's place to the flat. Yes, I'm a little teary-eyed from counselling, but this time I'm not wearing sunglasses. You know what? I am extremely proud of myself. The question of how Leon feels about the photos in Female is answered on my return to the flat. He has left a note for me on the fridge. Didn't cook dinner. Too famous for that now. I.e., I got Deliveroo to celebrate Catherine's / your success. Delicious Thai food in fridge for you. Kiss. Well, it seems he's not let it get to his head, so that's something. I stick the Thai food in the microwave, humming Stronger, What Doesn't Kill You, and reach for a pen while it whirs. Leon's working until Wednesday, then off to his mum's. I won't see him in person before Richie's trial on Friday. He's keeping busy. He's off on his last Johnny White visit tomorrow morning, planning on taking the earliest train he can to Cardiff and getting back in time for a nap before he's back to work. I'd point out that that's not enough sleep for him to function on, but I can tell he's not sleeping well even when he's here, so maybe it's better for him to be out and about. He's finally finished the bell jar, a sure sign he's awake in the daytime, and seems to be surviving on caffeine mostly. At this point in the month, we are not usually running this low on instant coffee. I keep it brief. I'm glad you've taken well to your new life of celebrity. I, on the other hand, am now embarrassingly jealous of about 100 women on the internet who think you are so yummy, lol, and have decided I much prefer it when it's just me that gets to stare at you. I'm crossing my fingers that Johnny White VIII is the one. Kiss, kiss. When the reply comes the next evening, I can tell Leon's exhausted. It's something about the handwriting, it's looser than usual, like he couldn't muster the energy to hold the pen tight. Johnny White VIII is not our guy. Is actually very unpleasant and homophobic. Also made me eat a lot of out-of-date fig rolls. Richie says hi. He's okay. Holding up. Kiss. Richie may be holding up, but I'm not convinced that Leon is.
Chapter 56. Late for work. Talked to Richie for 20 minutes he couldn't really afford about PTSD. It's the first time in a long time that I've talked to Richie about something other than the case, which is strange, as appeal is in 3 days' time. Think Gertie has spoken to him so often he actually wanted a change of topic. Asked him about restraining orders too. He was clear on the subject. It's for Tiffy to decide. Would be bad idea for me to seem to be imposing decisions on her. I must let her come to that conclusion on her own. Still hate that the ex knows where she lives, but must remember it is not my place to say. Late now. Button up shirt on my way out of building. I'm an expert at efficient flat departure. It's all in the shaved off seconds and the foregoing of Brinner, which will come to haunt me at 11 p.m. when day nurses have eaten all the biscuits. Strange man from flat 5 talks to me.
Leon.
Look up as building door slams shut behind me. It's strange man from flat 5. The one who, according to Tiffy, does energetic aerobics at 7 a.m, sharp, and accumulates banana crates in his parking space. Surprised to discover he knows my name. I answer, hi?
I never believed you were a nurse.
I'm running late for work, so... Strange man from flat 5 waves his mobile phone at me, like I should be able to discern what is on screen. He speaks to me again triumphantly.
You're a famous person.
Pardon?
You're in the Daily Mail. Wearing a poncy famous person jumper.
Poncy is no longer a politically correct term, strange man from flat five. Got to go. Enjoy the rest of female. Scarper as quickly as possible. Decide on reflection not to pursue life as celebrity. Mr. Pryor is awake for long enough to see the photos. He'll drop off again soon, but I know this will amuse him, so make sure to take the opportunity and get pictures up on phone screen. 14,000 likes and a photo of me staring into distance in a black t-shirt and enormous crocheted scarf. Odd, Mr. Pryor comments.
Very dashing, Leon.
Why, thank you.
Now, am I right that a certain fine young lady persuades you to humiliate yourself in this fashion?
It was Tiffy's idea.
Ah, the flatmate.
And the girlfriend?
No, not girlfriend. Not yet.
No.
Last we spoke, I got the impression you were rather smitten with each other.
Check Mr. Pryor's chart, keeping face carefully blank. Deranged liver function tests? Not good. To be expected, but still, not good. I'm that. Just don't rush things. I don't think she does either. Mr. Pryor frowns. His little beady eyes almost disappear under the folds of his eyebrows.
May I offer you some advice, Leon?
I nod.
Don't let your natural reticence hold you back. Make it clear how you feel about her. After all, you're something of a closed book, Leon.
Closed book? Notice that Mr. Pryor's hands tremble as he smooths down the bedspread and try not to think about prognostics. Mr. Pryor speaks to me again.
Quiet. Brooding. I'm sure she finds it very attractive. But don't let it be a barrier between you. I left it too long to tell my... I left things too late, and now I wish I'd just said what I wanted when I still could. Think what my life could have been. Not that I'm not happy with my lot, but you do waste an awful lot of time when you're young.
Can't do anything around here without someone imparting wisdom in your direction. But Mr. Pryor has made me a little nervous. Felt after Wales I shouldn't rush things with Tiffy. But maybe I'm holding back too much. I tend to, apparently. Wish I'd mentioned about changing to day shifts now. Still, I did go to a Welsh castle for her and pose against a windswept tree in large cardigan. Surely that makes my feelings clear. On the phone to Richie again.
You're not a naturally open person.
I am. I'm forthcoming, expressive, an open book.
You're not bad at the old talking about feelings with me, but that doesn't count. And it's usually because I do it first. You should take a leaf from my book, bro. I've never had any time for the whole hard to get thing. Easy to get and put it on the line has always worked for me.
Feel a bit wrong-footed. Was feeling good about everything with Tiffy, and I'm anxious now. Shouldn't have told Richie what Mr. Pryor said. Should have known what his opinion would be. Richie was writing love songs to serenade girls in school corridors when he was 10 years old. What am I meant to do then?
Fucking hell, man. Just tell her you like her and you want to make things official. You clearly do, so it can't be hard. I have to go. Gertie's got me talking her through the 10 minutes after leaving the club again. Seriously, I'm not sure that woman is human.
That woman is...
Don't worry. I won't hear a word against her. I was going to say superhuman.
Good.
Hot too.
Don't you even... Richie belly laughs. I find myself grinning. I can never resist smiling with him when he laughs like that.
I'll be good. But if she gets me out of here, I'm buying her dinner. Or asking her for her hand in marriage, maybe.
Smile fades a little. I feel a twinge of worry. The appeal is really happening. 2 days to go. I haven't even let myself imagine a scenario where Richie is found not guilty. But my brain keeps going there against my will, playing out the scene. Bringing him home to sit in Tiffy's paisley beanbag, drink beers, be my little brother again. Can't find the words for what I want to tell him. Don't get your hopes up. But of course he will. I have too. That's the whole point. So, do Don't let it get to you if it doesn't work. Also ridiculous. No good words for the magnitude of the problem. See you Friday.
That's the open book I know and love. See you Friday, bro.
Chapter 57. It's first thing on Friday. The day. Leon is at his mum's place. They're going to court together. Rachel and Mo are at mine. Mo's tagging along to the book launch. Given everything I've done for this book, even Martin could not deny me a plus one. Gertie pops in with Mo when he arrives, for a quick, cursory hug and a very hurried chat about Rich's case. She is already dressed in her ridiculous lawyer wig, as if she's doing an impression of an 18th century painting. Mo is in his tux, looking adorable. I love it when Mo dresses up smartly. It's like when you see photos of puppies dressed up as humans. He is visibly uncomfortable, and I can tell he's itching to at least take off his shoes, but if he so much as reaches for his shoelaces, then Gertie snarls at him and he withdraws, whimpering. When Gertie leaves, he looks visibly relieved. Just so you know, Mo and Gertie are totally shagging, Rachel tells me, passing me my hairbrush. I stare at her in the mirror. There are nowhere near enough mirrors in this flat. We should have got ready at Rachel's, which has an entire wall of mirrored cupboards in the bedroom for what I suspect to be sexual reasons, but she refuses to let Gertie in her flat since she made a comment about how messy it was at Rachel's birthday party. Mo and Gertie are not shagging, I say, coming to my senses and snatching the hairbrush. I'm attempting to tame my mane into a sleek updo from one of our DIY hairstyling books. The author promised me that it was easy, but I've been on step two for 15 minutes. There are 22 steps in total and half an hour left on the clock. They are, Rachel says matter-of-factly. You know I can always tell. I just about refrain from informing Rachel that Gertie also thinks she can always tell when a friend is sleeping with someone. I don't want this to become a competition, especially as I've still not had sex with Leon. They live together, I say through a mouthful of hairpins. They're more comfortable with each other than they used to be. You only get that comfortable if you get naked together, Rachel insists. That's weird and gross. Anyway, I'm pretty sure Mo is asexual. Belatedly, I check that the bathroom door is closed. Mo is in the living room. He has spent the last hour looking either patient or bored, depending on whether he thinks we're looking. You want to think that because of the whole he's like a brother to you thing, but he's definitely not asexual. He came on to my friend Kelly at a party last summer. I cannot handle these sorts of revelations right now, I say, spitting out the hairpins. I put them between my teeth way too early. They're step four, and step three still has me flummoxed. Come here, Rachel says, and I breathe out. Thank God. You really left me hanging there, I tell her as she takes the hairbrush, smooths out the damage I've done so far, and flicks through the updo instructions with one hand. How else will you ever learn? She says. It's 10 a.m. It's weird being in formal dress this early in the morning. For some reason, I'm incredibly paranoid about dripping tea down the front of my fancy new dress, though I'm pretty sure if I were drinking a martini, I wouldn't have the same anxieties. It's just weird drinking from a mug while wearing silk. Rachel has outdone herself. My hair is all smooth and shiny, knotted at the nape of my neck in a series of mysterious swirls, just like in the picture. The side effect, though, is that a copious amount of my chest is on show. When I tried this dress on, I had my hair down. I didn't really notice quite how much skin the off-the-shoulder sleeves and structured sweetheart neckline leave exposed. Oh well. This is my night too. I'm the acquiring editor. I'm perfectly entitled to dress inappropriately. My alarm beeps to remind me to check in on Catherine. I call her, trying not to notice that she's higher up my most called list than my own mother. Are you ready? I ask as soon as she picks up.
Almost, she trills. Just made a quick adjustment to the outfit and...
What quick adjustment? I ask, suspicious.
Oh, well, when I tried it on again, I realised how dour and boring this dress that your PR people picked makes me look under the bright lights of the day. So I've tweaked the hemline and the neckline.
I open my mouth to tell her off and then close it again. Firstly, the damage is clearly already done. If she's re-hemmed, the dress is unsavable. And secondly, my risque dress choice will look much better next to someone else who has also decided to show an unprofessional amount of skin. Fine, we'll pick you up at 1:30.
Toodles,
she says, hopefully ironically, though I'm not sure. I check the time as I hang up. 10 minutes spare. I had to factor in time for Rachel to get ready, which always takes at least 50% longer than you think it will. She'll blame it on me for making her do my hair, obviously. But it's really because she is the self-proclaimed queen of contouring and spends at least 40 minutes subtly altering the shape of her face before she even gets started on eyes and lips. I'm just about to text Leon and see how he is when the flat phone rings. What the fuck is that? Shouts Rachel from the bathroom. It's our landline, I yell, already making a dash for the sound. It seems to be coming from the vicinity of the fridge. Dashing is not easy in this outfit. There's a lot of billowing in the skirt region, and at least two risky moments where my bare foot catches in the tulle as I go. I wince as it yanks at my bad ankle. I can walk on it now, but it's not enjoying this running thing. Not that my good ankle likes running either. It's your what? Mo asks, sounding amused. Our landline, I repeat, fumbling around with the unbelievably large quantity of things on our kitchen surfaces. I'm sorry, you didn't tell me this was the 1990s, calls Rachel just as I find the phone. Hello?
Tiffy.
I frown. Richie? Are you all right?
I'll be honest with you, Tiffy. I'm shitting myself. Not literally, though it might be a matter of time.
Whoever it is, I hope they're enjoying the latest Blur CD, Rachel calls. Hang on. I head for the bedroom and close the door firmly behind me. With difficulty, I rearrange my skirt so that I can perch on the edge of the bed without anything ripping. Shouldn't you be, I don't know, in a van or something? How are you calling me? They have remembered your court date, right? I've heard enough horror stories from Gertie and Leon now to know that prisoners don't always make it to court when they should, thanks to the various prison-related bureaucracies that are required to overlap in this situation. They moved Richie down to an even grimmer London prison a few days ago so he'd be in the area for the trial, but there's still the journey from the prison to the courthouse. I feel physically sick at the thought of all this preparation going to waste because someone forgot to call someone else about transportation.
No, I've done the van bit. Barrel of laughs, let me tell you. Somehow spent 5 hours in there, though I could have sworn we weren't moving for half of it. No, I'm at the courthouse now, in a holding cell. I'm not really allowed a phone call, but the guard is an Irish lady, and she says I remind her of her son, and that I look terrible. She told me to call my girlfriend, but I don't have one, so I thought I'd call you, since you're Leon's girlfriend and that's close enough. It was that or Rita from school, who I don't think I ever technically broke up with.
You're rambling, Richie. What's the matter? Is it nerves?
Nerves makes me sound like I'm an old lady. It's terror.
That does sound better. More horror movie, less fainting because your corset is too tight.
Exactly.
Is Gertie there?
I can't see her yet. She's busy doing whatever lawyers do anyway. I'm on my own now.
His tone is light and self-deprecating as always, but you don't have to listen hard to hear the tremor in his voice. You are not on your own, I tell him firmly. You have all of us. And remember, when we first spoke, you told me you're coming to terms with being in prison. Well, that's the worst case scenario here. More of what you've already coped with.
What if I vomit in the courtroom?
Then someone will clear the room and call a cleaner, and you'll pick up where you left off. It's not exactly going to make the judges think you're an armed robber, is it? He gives a strangled version of a chuckle. For a moment, there is silence.
I don't want to let Leon down. He's got his hopes up so high. I can't bear to let him down again. Last time was the worst thing. Honestly, it was the worst. Seeing his face.
You have never let him down, I say. My heart is thumping. This is important. He knows you didn't do it. The system let you both down.
I should have just taken it. Served my sentence and got out and let him get on with his life in the meantime. All this, it's only going to make everything worse for him.
Leon was going to fight no matter what you did, I say. He was never just going to let his little brother get picked on. If you'd given up, that would have hurt him. He takes a big, juddering breath and lets it out again. That's good, I say. Breathing. I hear that's good for those with delicate nerves. Have you got any smelling salts? That gets another chuckle, a little less strangled this time.
Are you calling me a pussy?
I fully believe that you're a very brave man, I tell him. But yes, I'm calling you a pussy, in case that helps you remember how brave you are.
You're a good girl, Tiffy.
I'm not a dog, Richie. And now that you're hopefully less green, can we go back to how you just said Leon's girlfriend? There's a pause.
Not Leon's girlfriend?
Not yet, I tell him. Well, I mean, we've not discussed that. We've only been on a few dates, technically.
He's mad about you. He might not say it out loud, but...
I feel a twinge of anxiety. I'm crazy about Leon, too. I spend most of my waking hours thinking about him, and a few of the sleeping ones, too. But, I don't know. The idea of him wanting to be my boyfriend makes me feel so trapped. I adjust my dress, wondering if I'm the one having the problem with corsets and nerves. I really like Leon. This is ridiculous. Objectively, I would like to call him my boyfriend and introduce him to people as such. That's what you always want when you're crazy about someone. But what would Lucy say? Well, she'd probably say nothing, to be honest. She'd just leave me to stew on the fact that this weird fear of getting trapped is almost certainly to do with the fact that I was in a relationship with a man who never really let me go.
Tiffy, I should probably get going.
Oh, God, yes, I say, coming to my senses. I don't know what I'm doing worrying about relationship labels when Richie is about to walk into court. Good luck, Richie. I wish I could be there.
Maybe see you on the other side,
he says, voice trembling again.
And if not, look after Leon.
This time the request doesn't sound strange. I will, I tell him. I promise.
Chapter 58. Hate this suit. Lass wore it for court case number one, and then shoved it in wardrobe at Mam's place, tempted to burn it like it was contaminated. Glad I didn't. Can't afford to keep burning suits every time the legal system fails to deliver justice. This might not be our last appeal. Mam is weepy and shaking. I try so hard to be strong for her, but can't bear to be in the room with her. Would be easier with any other person, but with Mam, it's awful. I want her to mother me, not the other way round. And it almost makes me angry seeing her like this, even while it makes me sad. I check my phone. There's a text from Tiffy. I've just spoken to Richie. He called here for a bit of a morale boost. He's doing fine. You're all going to be fine, whatever happens. Text me if there's anything I can do. I can always duck out for a phone call. Tiffy. Kiss, kiss. I feel warm for a moment, after a morning of sustained cold fear. Remind myself of new resolve to tell Tiffy explicitly how I feel and move things in direction of seriousness, e.g. meeting parents, etc. Mam interrupts my thoughts. Sweetie. One last look in mirror, thinner, long-haired, stretched-out Richie stares back at me. I can't get him out of my head. I keep remembering how he looked when they read out his sentence. The endless barrage of nonsense about his cold-blooded, calculated crime. How his eyes went wide and blank with fear. Leon, sweetie, coming. Hello again, courtroom. It's so mundane. Nothing like the wooden seats and vaulted ceilings of American legal dramas. Just lots of files on desks, carpet, and tiered benches from which a few bored-looking lawyers and journalists have come to spectate. One of the journalists is trying to find a plug to charge his phone. A law student is inspecting the back of her smoothie bottle. It's bizarre. Earlier this year, I would have wanted to scream at both of them. Pay some fucking attention. You're watching someone's life being destroyed. But it's all part of the peculiar drama of this ritual. And now that we know how to play the game, now that we have a lawyer who knows the rules, the ritual doesn't bother me so much. A wizened man in a long cloak, like a Harry Potter character, enters with prison guard and Richie. Richie is not cuffed, which is something, but he looks just as bad as I suspected. He's bulked up in the last few months, exercising again, but with his shoulders slumped, the muscle seems to weigh him down. Can barely recognise him as the brother who first walked into the court last year, the one with the total confidence that if you're innocent, you walk out free. The brother who grew up at my shoulder, matching me step for step, always having my back. Almost can't look at him. It's too painful seeing the fear in his eyes. Somehow, from somewhere, I manage an encouraging smile when he looks at me and Mam. They put him in a glass box and close the door behind him. We wait. Journalist succeeds at plugging in phone and continues to scroll through what looks like the Reuters homepage, despite enormous sign forbidding use of mobile phones directly above his head. Smoothie bottle girl is now pulling loose threads out of fluffy scarf. Have to keep smiling at Richie. Gertie is here, dressed in that ridiculous outfit, almost indistinguishable from the rest of the lawyers, even though I've seen her eating Chinese takeaway in my kitchen. I feel myself bristling just at the sight of her. It's something guttural, instinctive now. Have to remind myself over and over that she's on our team. Wizened robe man. All rise. Everyone stands. Three judges file into the room. Is it generalising to point out that literally all of them are white, middle-aged men whose shoes look like they're worth more than my mother's car? I try to quell my rising hatred as they settle into their seats. Flick through the paperwork in front of them. Look up, finally, at Gertie and the prosecution barrister. Not one of them looks at my brother. Judge One speaks. Shall we begin?
Chapter 59. Catherine is a tiny, black-clad stick figure on the stage. Behind her, blown up to terrifying proportions, she's repeated in close-up. One screen is just her hand, so viewers can watch how she uses the crochet hook, and the other two focus on her face. It's amazing. The whole crowd is rapt. We're so overdressed for a daytime event about crochet, but Catherine insisted on the dress code. Despite all her anti-bourgeois values, she bloody loves an excuse to wear something fancy. Women in cocktail dresses gaze up at Catherine's enormous face, immortalised on the big screens beneath the vaulted ceiling. Men in tuxedos chuckle warmly at Catherine's witticisms. I even catch one young woman in a satin gown copying the movements of Catherine's hands, though all she's holding is a miniature goat's cheese canapé, no crochet hook in sight. Despite all of this, all its distracting absurdity, I can't stop thinking about Richie and the way his voice trembled on the phone. Nobody would notice if I just sneaked out. I might look a little incongruous for the courtroom, but maybe I could head via my flat and pick up a change of clothes for the taxi ride. God, I can't believe I'm considering paying for a taxi. Look! Rachel hisses suddenly, poking me in the ribs. Ow, what? Look, it's Tasha Chai Latte. I follow her pointing finger. A young woman dressed in a subtle lilac cocktail dress has just entered the crowd, a staggeringly attractive boyfriend in tow. An intimidating man in a tux follows the two of them, their bodyguard, presumably. Rachel's right, it's definitely her. I recognise the chiselled cheekbones from YouTube. Despite myself, I feel my stomach flutter a little. I'm such a sucker for a famous person. I can't believe she came. Martin will be ecstatic. Do you think she'll let me take a picture with her? Rachel asks. Above us, the gigantic Catherines on their screens smile out at the crowd and her hands hold up a finished square. It's the big man in the tux I'd worry about if I were you. She's filming! Look! Tasha Chai Latte's impossibly handsome boyfriend has pulled a compact, expensive-looking video camera out of his satchel and is fiddling with the buttons. Tasha checks her hair and makeup, dabbing a finger along her lips. Oh my God! She's going to put the event on her YouTube channel! Do you think Catherine will mention you in her thank you speech? We'll be famous! Calm down, I tell her, exchanging a look with Mo, who is currently working his way through the large pile of canapés he has been hoarding while everyone else is too distracted by crochet to capitalise on the food. Tasha's boyfriend lifts the camera, training it on Tasha's face. Immediately, she is wreathed in smiles, all thought of hair and makeup forgotten. Get closer, get closer! Rachel mutters, shooing Mo in the direction of Tasha. We shuffle along, trying to look nonchalant until we're just about close enough to hear them. Amazing lady, Tasha is saying. And isn't this place beautiful? Oh my God, you guys, I feel so lucky to be here and to be able to share it with all of you live. You know how I feel about supporting real artists, and that's exactly what Catherine is. The crowd bursts into applause. Catherine has finished her demonstration. Tasha gives an impatient gesture, telling her boyfriend to do another take. I guess they're warming up for the live stream. And now, a few thank yous, Catherine says from the stage. This is it, Rachel whispers excitedly. She'll definitely mention you. My stomach twists. I'm not sure I want her to mention me. There are a lot of people in this room, and an extra few million who will soon be watching via Tasha Chai Latte's YouTube channel. I adjust my dress, trying to inch it a little higher. I needn't have worried, though. Catherine starts by thanking her entire network of friends and family, which turns out to be extensive to the point of absurdity. I can't help wondering if she's taking the piss a bit. It would be just like her. The crowd's attention shifts. People begin to move around in search of Prosecco and tiny food. And finally, Catherine says grandly, there are two people who I just had to save until last. Well, that can't be me. It'll be a mum and dad or something. Rachel shoots me a disappointed look and then returns her attention to Tasha and her boyfriend, who are filming everything with quiet concentration on their faces. Two people without whom this book would never have happened, Catherine goes on. These two have worked so hard to make crochet your way possible. And even better than that, they believed in me from the very start, long before I was lucky enough to gather crowds this large for my events. Rachel and I turn to stare at one another. It won't be me, Rachel whispers, suddenly looking very nervous. She doesn't even remember my name most of the time. Tiffy and Rachel have been editor and designer on my books for the last 3 years, and they are the reason for my success, Catherine says grandly. The crowd applauds. I cannot thank them enough for making my book the best it can possibly be and the most beautiful it can possibly be. Rachel, Tiffy, will you get up here, please? I have something for you both. We gawp at one another. I think Rachel might be hyperventilating. I have never regretted an outfit choice more than I do now. I have to get up on stage in front of 1,000 people wearing something that only just covers my nipples. But as we stumble our way to the stage, which really does take quite some time, we weren't very near the front, I can't help noticing Catherine smiling down from her giant screens. In fact, she almost looks a little teary. God, I feel like a bit of a fraud. I mean, I have worked pretty much full-time on Catherine's book for the last few months, but I also complained about it a lot and didn't actually pay her very much to begin with. I'm on stage before I've really registered what's happening. Catherine kisses me on the cheek and hands me an enormous bouquet of lilies. Thought I'd forgotten you two, didn't you? She whispers in my ear with a cheeky smile. The fame's not gone quite that far to my head yet. The crowd is clapping and the sound echoes down from the roof until I can't tell where it's coming from. I smile, hoping that sheer willpower will be sufficient adhesive for the top of my dress. The lights are so bright when you're up here. They're like starbursts on the inside of my eyes every time I blink, and everything is either very white and shiny or black and shadowy, like someone's messed with the contrast. I think that's why I don't really notice the commotion until it reaches the front of the crowd, trembling its way through the throng, sending heads turning and people crying out as they stumble as though they've been pushed. Eventually, a figure shoves its way through and vaults onto the stage. I can't really see properly, eyes burned with all the lights, lily heads bobbing in front of me as I try to get a good handhold on the bouquet of flowers, and wonder how I'm going to get down off the stage in these shoes without being able to use the handrail. I recognise the voice, though, and once I've registered that, everything else drops away. "Can I have the mic?" says Justin, because of course, implausibly, impossibly, the figure pushing his way through the crowd was his. "I have something I want to say." Catherine's passed him the mic before she's even thought about it. She glances at me at the last moment, frowning, but it's already in Justin's hand. "That's Justin. He asks, he gets." He turns to face me. "Tiffy Moore," he says, "look at me." He's right. I'm not looking at him. As though he is holding me on strings, my head snaps around and my eyes meet his. There he is. Square jaw, perfectly trimmed beard, strong shoulders beneath his tuxedo jacket. Eyes soft and trained on my face as if I'm the only girl in the room. You can't see a trace of the man I've been talking about in counselling, the one who hurt me. This man is a dream come true. "Tiffy Moore," he begins again. Everything feels wrong, as if I've stepped into my sliding doors alternative world, and suddenly all trace of my other life, the one where I didn't need or want Justin, is threatening to desert me. "I have been lost without you." There's a pause. A lurching, sickening, echoing silence, like the long, raw note in your ears when the music stops. Then Justin drops down on one knee. All at once, I am aware of the crowd's reaction. They coo and ah, and I can see the faces on stage around me. Rachel's twisted in shock, Catherine's mouth open. I desperately want to run away, though I suspect that even if I could muster the strength, my legs would be too frozen to do everything required of them. It's as if the whole lot of us on stage are performing some sort of tableau. "Please," I begin. Why have I started pleading? I try the sentence again, but he doesn't let me. "You're the woman I'm meant to be with," he says. His voice is gentle but carries well with the microphone. "I know that now. I can't believe I ever lost faith in us. You're everything I could possibly want and more." He tilts his head, a gesture I used to find irresistible. "I know I don't deserve you. I know you're far too good for me, but..." Something twangs inside me as if it's pulled close to snapping. I remember how Gertie said Justin knows exactly how to play me, and there it is. the Justin who got me in the first place. Tiffany Moore, he says, will you marry me? There's something about his eyes. It was always his eyes that got me. As the silence stretches taut, it seems to tighten around my throat. The feeling that I'm in two places at once, that I'm two people at once, is so acute that it's almost like being half asleep and tugged between waking and dreaming. Here is Justin begging for me, the Justin I always wanted, the Justin I had right at the start, who I went through countless rows and breakups for, the one who I always believed was worth fighting for to get back. I open my mouth and speak, but without the microphone, my voice is lost behind the lilies. Even I can't hear my answer. She said yes, Justin yells, standing up, stretching his arms out wide. She said yes! The crowd erupts. The noise is too much. The light sears stripes under my eyelids, and Justin is bundling me in, hugging me close, his mouth on my hair, and it doesn't even feel strange. It feels like it always used to. His firm body against mine, the warmth of him, all horribly, perfectly familiar.
Chapter 60. Gertie starts speaking. Mrs. Wilson, as our first expert witness, please, could you begin by telling the judges what your expertise entails?
I'm a CCTV analyst and enhancer. Have been for 15 years. I work for the UK's leading CCTV forensics business. It was my team that pulled that enhanced footage together.
Gestures to screen.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Wilson.
And in your experience of examining CCTV footage, what can you tell us about these two short clips that we have seen today?
Plenty. They're not the same bloke to start with.
Really? You sound absolutely sure of that.
Oh, sure as anything.
For starters, look at the colour of the hoodie in the enhanced footage. Only one hoodie is black. You can tell by the shade that it comes out as. See? The black is a denser colour. Can we have images from both up on screen, please?
Thank you.
And then, look at how they walk.
It's a fair imitation, all right, but the first bloke is clearly... is clearly drunk, my lords.
Look at how he's zigzagging. Almost walks into the display. Then the next guy walks much straighter and doesn't fumble or anything when he reaches for the knife. Our first bloke nearly dropped the beers. And with the new CCTV footage from outside Aldi, we can see the distinctively zigzagged walk more clearly.
Oh, yeah.
And of the group that we see walking by a few moments after the first figure, who we have identified as Mr. Toomey, would you be able to identify any of those figures as the man with the knife and the off-license?
Mr. Turner speaks to the judges. My lords, this is nothing but speculation.
Judge Waite.
No, we'll allow it. Ms. Constantine is calling on her witness's expertise.
Ms. Constantine continues. Mrs. Wilson, could any of those men have been the men in the off-license looking at this footage?
Oh, yeah.
Bloke in the far right. His hood is down. And he's not putting on the walk there. But look at how his shoulder drops with each step of his left foot. Look how he rubs his shoulder. The same gesture as the bloke on the off-license makes before he pulls out the knife.
Mr. Turner interjects. We are here to examine an appeal against Mr. Toomey's conviction. What is the relevance of implicating an unidentifiable bystander?
Judge Waite answers.
I see your point, Mr. Turner. All right, Ms. Constantine. Do you have any further questions which are pertinent to the case at hand?
None, my lord. I hope perhaps we can return to this discussion at a later date, should this case be reopened.
Prosecution lawyer Mr. Turner scoffs into his hand.
Gertie turns a freezing cold glare on him. I remember how Mr. Turner intimidated Richie at the last trial. Called him a thug, a violent-minded criminal, a child who took whatever he wanted. I watch Mr. Turner pale under Gertie's gaze. To my delight, even robed and wigged Mr. Turner is not immune to the power of Gertie's dirty looks. I meet Richie's eye, and for the first time all day, crack a genuine smile. Step outside in the break and switch on my phone. My heart's not exactly beating faster than usual, just beating louder. Bigger. Everything feels exaggerated. When I buy a coffee, it tastes stronger. When the sky clears, the sun is stark and bright.
I can't believe how well it's going in there. Gertie just doesn't stop.
Every single thing she says is so conclusive. The judges keep nodding. The judge never nodded first time round. I've imagined this too many times and now I'm living it. Feels as if I'm inside a daydream. A few messages from Tiffy. I go to tap out a brief reply. Palms sweaty. Almost afraid writing it down and sending will jinx it. Wish I could call her. Instead, I check Tasha Chai Latte's Facebook page. Tiffy says she's filming the book launch. There's already a video on her page with thousands of views. Looks like it's from the launch, judging by the vaulted ceiling and the holding image. I watch, settling down on bench outside the court building, ignoring the gaggle of paparazzi waiting there for a chance of shooting someone they might get paid for. It's Catherine's thank you speech. I smile as she talks about Tiffy. From what Tiffy says, editors never get much credit, and designers even less. I can see Rachel beaming as she takes the stage with Tiffy. Camera jolts. Someone pushing through to the front. As he jumps up on the stage, I realise who it is. Sudden, awful, guilt-inducing urge to leave courtroom and go to Islington. Sit forward, staring at the tiny video playing out on my screen. Video cuts after she said yes. Surprising how truly terrible it feels. Perhaps you never know how you feel about someone until they agree to marry someone else.
Chapter 61. Justin pulls me off the stage to the wings. I go with him because more than anything else I want the noise and the lights and the crowd to go away, but as soon as we're through the curtain I yank my hand from his grasp. My wrist sings out in pain. He was holding on tightly. We're in a narrow black-walled space to the side of the stage, which is empty aside from a black-clad man with a walkie-talkie and lots of cables around his feet. Tiffy? Justin says. The vulnerability in his voice is completely contrived, I can tell. What the fuck do you... I begin. I'm shaking all over. It's hard to stand, especially in these high heels. What was that? What was what? He reaches for me again. Rachel bursts through the curtain behind us, kicking off her shoes. Tiff! Tiffy! I twist towards her as she runs into me, letting her hold me tightly. Justin looks down at us both, eyes narrowed a little. I can see he's calculating something behind those eyes, so I turn my head into the thick mass of Rachel's braids and try very, very hard not to cry. Tiffy? Calls someone else. It's Mo. I can't work out where he is. Your friends are here to congratulate you! Justin says benevolently, but his shoulders are stiff and tensed. Mo? I call. He appears from behind Justin through the curtains that separate us from the main backstage area. His jacket has gone, and his hair is mussed as though he's been running. In a moment, he's at my side. Behind me, I can hear Catherine valiantly trying to bring the subject back to Crochet Your Way on stage. Justin watches the three of us. Rachel still has hold of me, and I lean into her as I look up at Justin. You know I didn't say yes, I say flatly. His eyes widen. What do you mean? He says. I shake my head. I know what this is. I remember this feeling, the nagging sense of wrongness. You can't make me believe something that I know isn't true. There's a flicker behind his eyes. Maybe he's thinking I already have, plenty of times. Not anymore, I say. And you know what it's called when you do that? It's called gaslighting. It's a form of abuse. Telling me things aren't the way I can see them. This knocks him. I'm not sure Rachel or Mo will notice it, but I watch him take the hit. The Tiffy he is familiar with would never have used words like gaslighting and abuse. Seeing him waver sends a rush of fearful excitement through me, like the feeling when you stand close to the edge as the train rushes by. You did say yes, he says. The light from the stage creeps between the curtains behind us, leaving a long stripe of yellow across the shadowy lines of Justin's face. I heard you, and you do want to marry me, don't you, Tiffy? We belong together. He tries to reach for my hand. The whole thing is so obviously a performance. I pull back, and quick as a flash, Rachel reaches out and slaps his outstretched hand away from me. He doesn't physically react. When he speaks, his voice is light and wounded. What was that for? You don't touch her, Rachel spits at him. I think you should leave, Justin, Mo says. What is this all about, Tiffy? Justin asks me, voice still gentle. Are your friends upset with me because we were broken up? He keeps trying to move closer, just in inches, but Rachel has hold of me tight, and with Mo at my other shoulder, we're a unit. Can I ask you something? I say suddenly. Of course, Justin says. The sound guy in black glances at us in irritation. You're not meant to stay back here, he tells us as the crowd outside bursts into noisy applause. I ignore him, my eyes on Justin. How did you know I'd be here today? What do you mean? This event was advertised all over the place, Tiffy. I could hardly use the internet and miss it. But how did you know I would be here? How did you even know I was working on this book? I know I'm right. I can see it in the shiftiness in his eyes. He eases a finger under his collar. And how did you know I would be at that book launch in Shoreditch? And how did you know I'd be on that cruise ship? He's unsettled. He scoffs, giving me the first unpleasant, disparaging look of the evening. That's more like it. That's the Justin I've begun to remember. For a moment, he's caught in indecision, and then he opts for an easy smile. Your mate Martin has been giving me tip-offs, he says sheepishly, like a naughty boy caught pinching things. Sweet, mischievous, harmless. He knew how much I care about you, so he's been helping us get back together. You're joking, Rachel blurts. I glance at her, her eyes are flashing and she looks more terrifying than I've ever seen her looking before, which is really saying something. How do you even know Martin? I ask in disbelief. Quiet! The sound guy hisses. We all ignore him. We met at your work night out, remember? Justin says. Is this important? Can't we go somewhere quiet, just the two of us, Tiffy? I don't remember the work night out. I missed most of them because Justin never liked going and he didn't like me going to them without him. I don't want to go anywhere with you, Justin, I say, taking a deep, shaky breath. And I don't want to marry you. I want you to leave me alone. I have imagined saying this lots and lots of times. I always thought he'd look wounded, perhaps step back in shock or raise a hand to his mouth. I imagined him crying and trying to pull me closer. I'd even been afraid he might try to get hold of me physically and not let go. But he just looks perplexed, irritated, maybe a little pissed off, as if he's been terribly misled somehow and it's all been rather unfair. You don't mean that, he begins. Oh, she does, says Mo. His voice is pleasant but very firm. She really, really does, Rachel adds. No, Justin says, shaking his head. You're not giving us a chance. A chance? I almost laugh. I went back to you over and over. You've had more chances than I can count. I don't want to see you. Ever again. He frowns. You said in that bar in Shoreditch that we could talk in a couple of months. I stuck to your rules, he says, stretching his arms out. It's October, isn't it? A lot can change in a couple of months. I've been doing a lot of thinking, a lot of remembering. There it is again, a flicker of almost fear behind his eyes. He reaches for me one last time, and this time Rachel slaps him across the face. Couldn't have put it better myself, Mo mutters, and he pulls the two of us further back into the mess of cables and darkness as Justin stumbles backwards, eyes wide with shock. You out, the irate sound guy says firmly to Justin, clearly identifying him as the root cause of all the noise. He steps forward, forcing Justin further back. Steadying himself, Justin holds out a warning hand to the sound guy. He glances over his shoulder to find the exit and then turns back to find my gaze. For a moment, I lose the sense of Mo and Rachel behind me and the sound guy in here with us. It's just me and Justin's broad, tuxedoed body in this cramped, dark space, and I feel desperate as if I'm running out of air. It's only a second or two, but it's somehow worse than everything that's just happened put together. Then Justin backs out between the curtains into the backstage area with a rush of noise, and I melt shakily into Rachel and Mo. He's gone. It's over. But he's left that desperate breathlessness behind him, and as I grasp at Rachel and Mo's arms with clammy fingers, I feel a sudden, sickening fear that I won't ever be able to shake him, no matter how many times I see him walk away.
Chapter 62. Can't think. Can't anything. Somehow find my feet and get back to the courtroom, but the daydream feeling has morphed into an aura of unreality around everything. Mechanically, I smile at Richie. Notice how bright his eyes are, how hopeful he looks. Fail to feel anything. It's probably the shock. I'll recover shortly and get my head back into the hearing. I can't believe anything has managed to distract me from this. I feel suddenly furious with Tiffy, choosing today of all days to dump me and go back to Justin. And can't help but think of Mam. How she'd always go back to those men, no matter what Richie and I said. Some part of my brain reminds me Mam didn't want to be with those men. She just didn't think she was allowed to be anywhere else. She didn't think she meant anything if she was on her own. But Tiffy wasn't on her own. She had Mo, Gertie, Rachel, me. Richie, think of Richie. Richie needs me here. And there's no fucking way I'm losing him again, too. Gertie is summing up. Just about managed to listen. She's so good you can't help but follow her argument. Then, with a peculiar lack of fanfare, it's over. We all stand, judges leave. Richie is taken back to wherever he was brought from, with a wistful backwards glance. We walk through the court building in silence, Gertie tapping away at her phone, Mam cracking her knuckles incessantly. Mam looks sideways at me as we reach the entranceway.
Lee, what's wrong?
Then Gertie gives a little gasp, hand to mouth, glance over, dull-eyed, and notice that she's watching the video play out on Facebook. Oh my God.
What's happened?
Tiffy.
Your girlfriend. What's she done? She wouldn't.
She would. You know people do. Go back. It's hard to leave what you've known. Not her fault. But you know people do. Gertie's silence says enough. Suddenly more than anything I need to get away from here. We won't get a verdict over the weekend, will we?
No. It'll be next week. I'll call you when...
Thanks. And I'm gone. Walk. And walk. Can't cry. I'm just dry-throated and aching-eyed. I'm sure that some of this fear is about Richie. But all I can think about is Justin, arms out yelling, "She said yes!" to the whooping crowd. Play out every scene. The endless notes. Brighton. The night eating tiffin together on the sofa. The trip to Holly's party. Kissing against the aga. My gut twists at the memory of how her body would go cold when she thought of him. But then I harden myself. Don't want to feel sorry for her. For now, just want to feel betrayed. Can't help it, though. Can't stop thinking of the way her knees would shake. Ah, there we go. There's the tears. Knew they'd turn up eventually.
Chapter 63. The smell of lilies is suffocating. Mo's holding the bouquet beside me as we huddle there in the darkness, the blooms pressing close to my dress, staining the fabric with pollen. As I look down at the marks on the silk, I notice I'm shaking so much the full skirt of my dress is quivering. I don't remember exactly what Justin said as he left. In fact, I already feel like I don't remember a lot of the conversation that just happened. Perhaps it was all a surreal daydream, and I'm actually still standing out there in the crowd, wondering if Catherine will mention me in her thank you speech, and whether those little roll things on the canapé tray are duck or chicken. What if you're still right there? I whisper to Rachel, pointing towards the black curtains Justin left through. Mo, hold this, Rachel says. I think this is referring to me. She disappears through to the backstage area, while on stage Catherine says goodbye to the audience to resounding applause. Mo dutifully holds my elbow. You're okay, he whispers. He doesn't say anything else, he just does one of those hug-like sort of silences that I love so much. In the world on the other side of these dark curtains, the crowd is still clapping. Muffled here, the sound is like heavy rain on tarmac. You can't be back here, the sound guy insists in exasperation as Rachel re-enters. He takes a step backwards when she turns to look at him. I don't blame him. Rachel has her battle face on and she looks bloody terrifying. Rachel sweeps past him without answering, lifting her skirts to step over the cables. No crazy ex in sight, she tells me, returning to my side. Catherine bundles in suddenly from the stage. She almost walks into Mo. Gosh, she says. That was all rather dramatic, wasn't it? She pats me in a motherly sort of way. Are you all right? I'm assuming that fellow was... Tiffy's stalker ex-boyfriend, Rachel supplies. And speaking of stalking, I think we need to have a few words with Martin. Not now, I beg, grabbing hold of Rachel's arm. Just stay with me for a minute, all right? Her face softens. Fine. Permission to hang him by the testicles at some later time? Granted. Also, ew. I can't believe he's been telling that scumbag where you are all the time. You should press charges, Tiffy. You should certainly file for a restraining order, Mo says quietly. Against Martin? Might make work awkward, I say weakly. Mo just looks at me. You know who I meant. Can we leave this dark curtain room now? I ask. Good idea, says Catherine. Discreetly, out of Rachel's sight, the sound guy nods and rolls his eyes. I'd better go and mingle, but why don't you lot take my limo? I beg your pardon, Rachel says, staring at her. Catherine looks sheepish. It wasn't my idea. The Butterfingers PR team got it for me. It's just sitting outside. You can take it. I can't be seen dead getting driven round in one of those. They'd never let me back into the old socialists' club. Thanks, Mo says, and I briefly surface from the fog of panic to marvel at the thought that the head of PR voluntarily shelled out for a limousine. She is infamously tight on budget. So now we just need to get out, through the crowd, Rachel says, her mouth set in a grim line. First, though, you need to call the police and report Justin for harassment, Mo tells me. And you need to tell them everything. All the other times, the flowers, Martin. I let out a half-groan, half-whimper. Mo rubs my back. Tiffy, do it, Rachel says, handing me her phone. I move through the throng as though I'm somebody else. People keep patting me on the back and smiling and calling to me. At first, I try to tell everyone in turn. I didn't say yes. I'm not getting married. He's not my boyfriend. But either they can't or they don't want to hear me, so as we get closer to the door, I stop trying. Catherine's limo is parked around the corner. It's not just a limo. It's a stretch limo. This is ridiculous. The head of PR must be about to ask Catherine to do something very important for very little money. Hi, excuse me, Rachel says to the limo driver through the window in her best sweet-talking the barman voice. Catherine said we can have this limo. A lengthy conversation ensues. As probably should be the case, the limo driver is not about to just take our word for it that Catherine has let us take the car. After a brief phone call to Catherine herself and the return of Rachel's battle face, we're in, thank God. I'm shivering like crazy, even with Mo's jacket over my shoulders. Inside is even more ridiculous than outside. There are long sofas, a small bar, two television screens and a sound system. Fucking hell, Rachel says.